Hello, my name's Dr. Thomas Round. I'm a GP in London and I'm the RCGP Essential Knowledge Updates Clinical Fellow. And today I'm interviewing Angelica Razak around the recent Dermatology EKU Module 2021 Volume 3. Hi, Angelique.
Hi, Thomas. Thank you very much for inviting me to speak on acne, a very, very common condition in general practice, and we all need to be familiar with its treatment. I'm a GP in Southeast London. I've had an interest in dermatology for as long as I can remember, back to med school, actually. And becoming a GP, I eventually sort of decided to embark on the Cardiff Diploma, and I'm now working for our local PCN, doing a community dermatology service, work also at King's College Hospital in the two-week weight clinic, and I'm the current chair of the Primary Care Dermatology Society.
And thank you so much for joining us. Really do appreciate your time to talk about acne. And this module was based on the Primary Care Dermatology Society acne guidelines, which thank you for letting us utilise those for the essential knowledge updates. And really just to touch on acne, tell us about sort of how common it is. I think most of us will feel reasonably confident in diagnosing common acne, but is there any sort of diagnostic pitfalls or challenges?
Oh, definitely. And I think it is fair to say that probably young people will at some point in their life have acne. The majority will outgrow it eventually, but there is a certain percentage that will carry on past their 20s. And we see acne also in older age groups, so sort of in the 40 to 50 age groups, and particularly in women. So there is a strong hormonal component that we are aware of that drives acne, and that may account for the incidence in older women. Most of patients probably will self-care. They might ask parents, they might ask their local pharmacist, they may go online, they may consult with friends and just kind of get treatments over the counter. So we do not see every patient or every person that develops acne in their life in the primary care setting. But given that about 30% of primary care consultations are related with any form of skin disease, there is a large proportion of acne there still that comes through our doors. There are some challenges in terms of differential diagnosis, and particularly acne rosacea, or rosacea as it's called now. It used to be called acne rosacea. It could be folliculitis. Keratosis pilaris is a very common condition, particularly in younger patients, children, that may be confused with acne. And those are the most commonest presentations and differentials. We have some very challenging presentations when people present with very severe acne, with very kind of cystic acne and scarring acne. And of course, people with skin of color are very distressed by their hyperpigmentation and hence therefore seek advice through general practice.
Thank you so much for that introduction. And obviously we're working through the COVID pandemic at the moment, meaning that doing a lot more online and virtual consultations, and maybe some people sending photos in. Have you found that strengths and weaknesses of that approach? Or have you found that sort of easier or more difficult with these skin consultations?
Yes, I agree. We certainly have seen a huge increase in online consultations, which has definitely opened up doors for patients that may otherwise have had difficulties speaking to us. Reviewing photographs, it very much depends on the quality of a photograph. Not often are very, very important clues missing in a photograph that may be blurred, that may be too close up, there may be suboptimal lighting. So it's very important that we get messages out to our patients where we expect to take photographs of skin and of pathology, that they have guideline how to best take a photograph. The Primary Care Dermatology Society has an excellent patient leaflet on their website that I would highly recommend for my colleagues that are dealing with e-consult or online consultations to distribute to their patients in order to get optimum photographs and make a sufficient diagnosis of a condition. And acne lends itself to it. We also have acne monitoring up on the website that actually can be very, very helpful for patients to use and monitor their acne and monitor treatment success.
That's really useful. Thank you. That's a good top tip for people listening to this podcast. Thank you. So once we've felt we've made the diagnosis of acne, what's your sort of first step with the patient? Do you give them any self-care advice? You know, people often talk about diet or skin washes. Is there any sort of guidelines on that?
I think in order to understand really what the treatment for acne needs to entail, we need to look a little bit at the pathophysiology. And I'm sorry about that, but because it might sound a little bit sort of med school-like, but it is very important to understand how acne actually develops. And in order for patients and for my colleagues also to understand why treatments are often not just one-fold, but that we need more than one treatment approach to manage acne sufficiently, I often explain pathophysiology behind acne. And it is obviously a very androgen-driven process that affects the pilosebaceous unit within the skin, which is plentiful on the face, the chest, and the back. Hence, that's where most of acne lesions develop. It is more an effect of the circulating androgen and the receptability than actually the amount of androgen that is around. So the seborrhea and also the androgen drive results in a proliferation within the follicles that leads to a clogging up of the follicle, and the sebum further promotes that. That creates an environment for the Propionibacterium acne that can then grow within the follicle and cause pustular and papular lesions. And that further then drives inflammation through activating cytokine pathways. So it is very complex how acne develops, and we need to target microcomedone that is often not visible to the skin, but that is there and needs to be targeted even once we've successfully treated acne.
That's really interesting. Thank you. A refresher there on the pathophysiology. I think that's really important. Some of us sometimes forget that, and actually the way you explained it was really helpful. Thank you.
Yes, I think if we then look at the actual treatment options, so we want to reduce the sebum production, we want to reduce the microcomedones, and for that it is actually most important to adding a topical retinoid and benzoyl peroxide. So the retinoid actually targets the microcomedone and any kind of blackheads, whiteheads, or open or closed comedones, as we call them. And the benzoyl peroxide targets the keratinocytes, resolves them, breaks down the thickening of the follicles, and also has an anti-inflammatory and an antibacterial effect. So this is a good treatment to start off with. And we actually have a combined treatment with adapalene and a benzoyl peroxide or epidural that is a once-daily application, and for mild acne is probably often a sufficient treatment if it is used long enough. And it is very important to tell our patients that often the effect is not visible until 6 to 8 weeks into the treatment. Hence, often us reviewing patients sort of earliest at 6 to 8 weeks, and sometimes depending on time in general practice, then at 3 months we definitely should do a first review.
Yeah, I think that's really important to note that patients may be expecting a quick fix when actually we may need to wait a little bit of time for this initial treatment to work.
Absolutely. And there is very, very good evidence that a good first consultation and explaining all this to our patients actually increases adherence and the more actually follow through with the treatment and has then very, very successful outcomes, which even avoids scarring of the face and worsening of the acne, but also reducing referrals to hospital.
And we mentioned there adapalene as a retinoid and benzoyl peroxide in combination as a first-line treatment to consider. Is there any advice you give patients on using these agents? I understand that there should be advice about maybe not getting pregnant if it's a female, sort of contraception use, maybe around UV light for some of these treatments.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, our advice, if a female that uses it finds out she's pregnant, to stop it. Our advice has not been to use concomitantly oral contraception, but the general conversation around using other barrier methods, for example, if they are sexually active, avoiding pregnancy. But if a female should fall pregnant, to stop it is the best action. And we have not had any of adverse outcomes reported.
Looking at this area, a lot of people may still use oral antibiotics potentially as first line, or that might be their usual kind of prescribing habit, though clearly we're under pressure to reduce unnecessary oral antibiotic prescribing with resistance. Is this an area we could maybe do some more work in?
Yes, I think so. And perhaps grading the acne that you see in your patient will help. So as I mentioned, the topical treatment with benzoyl peroxide and a retinoid is very favorable and very effective for patients with mild acne. So mild acne we would see in a patient that predominantly has comedonal acne. So you see the open comedones or blackheads and the closed comedones or whiteheads. And for that, targeted treatment with a combination treatment such as epidural is really, really effective. Now, if we then look further up on the severity ladder, a patient with moderate acne would also present with inflammatory papules. And in those patients, introducing antibiotics is certainly not wrong, even as the first line management, together with a topical retinoid or plus minus benzoyl peroxide.
The take-home message for me would be probably don't use oral antibiotics on their own. Always use them in combination with a topical agent.
Absolutely.
And obviously we mentioned sort of epidural maybe first line. Is there any other first line topical agents you might consider?
You could use adapalene just on its own or Differin. You could just use benzoyl peroxide on its own. There are other treatment options. For example, it's not available or it's not tolerated. You could instead use tretinoin or isotretinoin, although they are slightly more potent. Adapalene in sort of the retinoid armory is considered the best tolerated topical retinoid. Alternatively, azelaic acid, 20% or skinorin is a good alternative, but often more second line to topical retinoid and benzoyl peroxide. I would also point out that I always tell my patients you're using medicine on your face. This is medicated treatments and they can have side effects. And if that is not being explained and patients are counseled about the side effects, which often leads to treatment discontinuation and treatment failure. So I always explain that these treatments can be irritating to the skin. And the best approach is actually to gently introduce them and perhaps just use them twice weekly overnight, or just have a short contact of just leaving it on for an hour and every night and then washing it off after an hour. So that depends how motivated patients are, how much it fits into their adherence. You know, are they very religious about doing their treatments, or is twice weekly much easier to remember? You know, Monday or Thursday are my days when I'm putting the active treatment on. So that's something you negotiate with the patient what works best for them. But it's important to point out the potential side effects. Benzoyl peroxide obviously has also a further side effect that it stains or bleaches. So I always advise my patients when you're using this, just have an old pillowcase so it doesn't rub off onto your pillows.
Well, from having acne as a teenager and using benzoyl peroxide, I can account for the staining of the towels. I absolutely would say, as you always advise patients, to maybe have a white towel because then there's no staining, or white bed sheets, and then there's not an issue. And obviously washing hands after use. And same for you, I advise slow introduction of the agent, and it can cause drying out of the skin. I've only once actually seen someone with a bad reaction to a retinoid. That was just one time where I got a sort of a dermatitis eczema from using it.
Yes.
I think that's quite rare, as I understand.
It is quite rare, and often the initial effects are more burning and tightness of the skin, and then often our patients sadly already stop rather than saying I'm just stepping down and I give my skin a day or two a break and then reapply. And hence we are often hearing when patients consult, I have tried this, it didn't work, I've tried that, it gave me an allergic reaction. So there's a lot of myths and misconceptions that we have to unravel in our consultations with patients.
That's really useful. So in a way, it's actually investing a little bit of time up front can help with patient management and actually avoiding maybe referrals or unnecessary treatments.
Absolutely. And patients are eternally grateful if in their first consultation, they have a little bit more time to take all this in. And of course, backing it up with information leaflets, there are a lot around. The British Association of Dermatologists has got good leaflets. I always refer to the PCDS website as well for patients to just go over what I've just explained to them to reread on that, because everybody is on the World Wide Web and gathers information, and it's important that we give evidence-based information and don't direct them into sources that may just raise anxieties.
I find actually the use of text messaging really useful as well, to send patients a summary of the consultation and some link that they can have a look at.
Absolutely, and we've been very, very fortunate. That's one of the advantages the COVID has given general practice, the advance in technology and using various technological features to actually communicate with our patients and getting information to them.
I've actually heard recently there's been a supply issue with adapalene. I don't know if you're aware of that, but that's actually some patients came back to me and I couldn't remember what the alternative retinoid would be. Is it treclin gel? Is that correct?
Well, treclin also has an antibiotic, clindamycin. So yes, that could be an alternative. And particularly if we are talking about moderate acne, where we have papules and pustules, which are often a sign that there is a lot of propionibacterium acne active on the skin. And hence a topical antibiotic may be helpful in the initial management. And if that is not helpful, then to step up topical plus oral antibiotics. That would be my management for moderate acne. And again, it is often worth starting with a topical combination treatment and then stepping up to oral antibiotics.
Do you still use Duac in practice?
Yes, again, if there are papules and pustules, because again, it's a combination of clindamycin and benzyl peroxide. So again, if there is pustule formation, papules, then a topical antibiotic is indicated.
We'd arrange initial follow-up at 6 weeks or potentially longer, depending on the treatment
Absolutely.
Regime.
Absolutely. I usually tell my patient, don't expect any improvement until 6 to 8 weeks into the treatment. So it is, as you said, not a quick fix. And time permitting, if I have enough appointments available, I will book them in for 8 weeks. But latest at 12 weeks, I think we should have a review to see whether there is a good treatment response, whether we need to actually step up or try a different treatment.
And then if we were reviewing a patient at 12 weeks and maybe they've started on epiduro and not a great effect, what would your next line treatment be if it was mild to moderate?
Again, depending on the predominant lesion that we see, if there are papules and pustules, then I would step up to an oral antibiotic and preferably limacycline or doxycycline once daily for up to 3 months and then review. The maximum I would ever give antibiotics if there is a response is up to 6 months. But if there hasn't been a response after 3 months, then change to a different antibiotic for a further 3 months. If that hasn't worked, then a referral to secondary care is indicated. But I give it 2 treatment cycles to see whether there is a response or not and whether perhaps Roaccutane or isotretinoin orally is a better choice.
And in terms of oral antibiotics, is there any differentiation between doxy or limacycline, or you just try one or the other and rotate?
My preferred choice is limacycline, and I think I'm talking here for the majority of dermatologists who use limacycline first line for acne, in particular as moderate papulopustular acne, and also for very severe acne whilst waiting for the referral to come through. That seems to be in the UK the first line treatment, actually. And if that doesn't work, then switching to doxycycline as the second choice. There is a lot of resistance now to treatments such as erythromycin, which used to be the first choice for acne treatment and is still the first choice for children under the age of 12 and for pregnant women if you should have to treat whilst very young or pregnant and suffering. And tetracyclines have gone a little bit out of fashion. I remember the days when we treated with oxytetracycline, but because of the twice daily dosation, it is always thought that adherence to treatment regimes is better with a once daily treatment, hence limacycline and doxycycline being preferred as the choices for acne treatment.
We talked a little bit about sort of contraception, and as I understand, some of the combined contraceptive pills actually can be part of acne treatment. Do you often have that discussion if women are interested in the pill, discussing that at the same time?
Yes, definitely. And particularly if they've had treatments before, they've had oral antibiotics that perhaps haven't worked. And yes, of course, if there is a request for also contraception, then it's definitely worthwhile considering. There is a lot of talk about which combined oral contraceptive is the best one. Traditionally, we've treated a lot with cyproconazole, actually, or the Dianet in the past. And given the higher VTE risk, it's probably been used a bit more cautiously. And if then only for 3 months, and then switching to the second generation combined oral contraceptive. And again, there are different opinions, which one is the best? Is it Microgynon, or some swear it's Marvelon, others say Yasmin. So there are many, many brands. And I think I would go by local formularies, which are recommended in your local area as first choice, because most do actually have the same effect on women that suffer with acne. And we have to obviously take into account VTE risk. Again, is only greatest in the first 3 months. After that, it is a lot less. So it's a debate around this. And yeah, I don't have a preferred one. Sometimes women already have had an oral contraceptive in the past and they want to restart and they were very happy with that method. And I will reconsider even in combination with their acne treatment. What I would like to say, though, is that all progesterone methods are probably best avoided because they could actually exacerbate acne or worsen acne. So being the progesterone-only pill or the injection, the depot, or including actually the Marina coil and the implant are all methods that could potentially aggravate acne.
I guess we touched a little bit briefly about when to refer to dermatology. So that might include, like as we said, if we've had treatment failure. I guess if a patient presented on the first consultation with severe acne, we might consider getting a dermatology opinion and starting treatment. I guess the key thing I always say to patients is we can actually prescribe everything in primary care except for Accutane with the severe cases with scarring. Is that sort of your approach?
Yes, absolutely. I always go back and what they've tried already and whether they've really religiously have been sticking to their treatment plan and whether there would be somewhere a way of optimizing it. And sometimes people do say, yes, I actually didn't take it for the time that I was meant to take because it just upset my skin. You know, it became very dry and sore and I just didn't like the treatment. So I always have that discussion with patients that if used in a sensitive manner, then it could actually give a good result already because the Roaccutane, of course, is not without side effects either. And what they've experienced perhaps with topical treatments might be a lot worse with taking the oral preparation of isotretinoin. So it's always a balancing act. What are patients prepared to sign up for? It's no use us referring to secondary care if we haven't had conversation in primary care what it actually means for women also. So signing up to the pregnancy prevention program and perhaps even having monthly pregnancy test and get their prescriptions. It's a lengthy treatment. I often talk about side effects associated with it and particularly the dry skin, but that it could affect also their liver, that their cholesterol and lipids could temporarily raise whilst they're on the treatment. And of course, also that there is a perceived risk of mental health issues, including suicidality with isotretinoin. So these are all discussions we have to have in primary care already before we make the referral, because a patient really needs to be informed before they make a decision. This is actually the treatment I would want to sign up to and carry through for the 4 to 6 months or sometimes even longer.
So as you say, definitely an option for severe acne with scarring, but it is a big commitment. And actually, there's a lot we can do, as we've talked about in primary care, optimizing treatment and shared care management plans.
Yes. Where I definitely would recommend it is for those patients that have very severe acne, so very widespread acne that does not respond to oral antibiotics and where there are signs perhaps even of scarring. In that, I mean, not just hyperpigmentation, but evidence of atrophic scars or even hypertrophic scars and keloids. Those patients definitely should be referred quite urgently to avoid further scarring, because that is why we are treating acne. The prevention of scarring, because that is long-lasting sign that is very difficult to manage afterwards and with very, very few options on the NHS. So I think that should be our utmost aim to prevent that. And if we see somebody with very severe papulopustular acne or even the nodular cystic acne, they definitely need to be referred.
I've seen some female patients who've seen dermatology started on spironolactone off license. Is that something that you've seen? Is there any evidence around that?
Yes, I think it is a very effective treatment for a certain cohort of patients, of course, and it's very difficult. It's probably not something that we would at present initiate in primary care, but I think some of my colleagues actually do feel very strongly about it, that this would be an addition to our armory that we have got at the moment in primary care. So I'm watching this space that perhaps there will be some guidelines at some stage for us in primary care to maybe even in a certain cohort of patients to use.
NICE had updated acne guideline, which is currently out for consultation, likely to be published later in this year. After a quick look at this, is there any kind of major changes from that, or is it quite similar to what we've talked about today?
I would say it very much reflects what we've been talking about today. I think the only thing that where it differs slightly from the Primary Care Dermatology Society treatment pathway for acne is that they recommend treatment with oral antibiotics if there is some response and improvement to it, even extending it to 6 months, whilst we have always maintained 3 months as the maximum. And if we don't see a response or no sufficient or just partial response, to change to a different one. And I'm almost thinking that this, even given antibiotic stewardship, that this may be a very valuable and reasonable treatment approach, given that we do have some late responders. And if there is a partial good effect from antibiotics, why not carrying on a bit longer to see whether we can optimize it and then stepping down, which of course for many acne sufferers might be something that they will have to carry on for a considerable time, and sometimes again stepping up again and repeating courses of antibiotics.
What does the future hold for acne treatment? Is there any new treatments or therapies on the horizon?
Not to my knowledge, but I'm sure as we speak, people are thinking about it. It's been quite sad that it's been around for so many years and we still haven't got much more to offer than what we've got at the moment. But I think we've got some very decent treatments anyway. And I think it's often just a matter of supporting our patients in adhering to the treatments, and they will then have a very, very good response. So it's us in primary care actually supporting patients and encouraging them to carry on and guiding them through supporting that. Sadly, it is considered now a chronic condition, but we can always give hope by saying the majority will actually outgrow the acne and eventually their skin will normalize.
And I guess, as we say, often these patients can be teenagers or young adults, which yeah. can sometimes struggle with access to primary care. And as you say, the key thing is compliance and trying the medications out gradually and not expecting a quick fix.
Absolutely. I think those are the key messages, and perhaps also not thinking that this is anything contagious. It has nothing to do with being unhygienic. On the contrary, patients should not wash more often than twice a day, sort of with gentle cleansers, and still use emollients that are non-greasy, non-oily. Makeup can still be used, but it should be non-comedogenic and it should be removed every day. So there are still a lot of myths where we have to support our patients in getting their perfect skin.
If people want to look at more information, there's the Primary Care Dermatology Society website, which we link to on the module. I think there's a lot more guidance and, as we said, information leaflets on that website.
I would strongly recommend to look at our primary care treatment pathways, which is a summary of what we've just discussed on 2 pages. So it's a very, very good and easy to use desktop guide. And the website, of course, has got their A to Z and has got a chapter on acne and also the different presentations we haven't touched upon with acne and differential diagnosis. So anybody that has developed a further interest and wants to know more about it, I think that would be a good learning module.
Thanks so much, Angelica, for your time today. Really interesting discussion with you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You are listening to the RCGP Essential Knowledge Updates podcast. Thanks for listening.